I began encountering Lefebvre, as many Anglophone urbanists do, through in translation, through this ubiquitous volume, Lefebvre, Writings on Cities. And I confess, I first turned to Lefebvre as something of an analytic political theorist in a kind of Rawlsian vein, essentially looking for ideas to poach. Having done that, I came to find him very interesting indeed, and at times captivating, and I'm now beginning to fight through the original texts and some of the original articles he wrote during the transition from really being a rural sociologist to an urban theorist, his engagement with the Situationists that ended so well. Much of the revival of interest, I think, in this book, among urbanists, certainly in urban geography, in urban studies, much has been written, obviously, tends to focus on the content of his right to the city and the prospects for its realization. So whatever a right to the city is, it's best understood in terms of how we use urban spaces, not the market value of those spaces or the conceits of rationalist planning. And because market forces and commercial interests so dominate our cities today, most elaborations of the right to the city, and this is both in theory and in practice, where it's a rallying cry for many political movements, quite rightly draw our attention to the political possibilities for challenging these neoliberal forces in our cities. Again, obviously vitally important efforts, and my interests, though, are largely conceptual and interpretive, and I came to this paper interested in two questions about Lefebvre's seminal claims about the right to the city. First, what might ground such a right, if it indeed needs grounding, perhaps it doesn't, and why we should think of it as a right at all. And second, why it's a right to the city, rather than to place more generally, or to specific place-bound needs. Now, the first question seems to me to be a problem for Lefebvre, if you believe that he's using the word right in a way that's familiar to most analytic philosophers. Marxists, of course, are famously skeptical of rights. Lefebvre quite clearly is a Marxist. So what's he doing talking about rights? Could it simply be opportunistic rhetoric? This was the late 60s, after all. It could be that he meant something quite different, as several people have, I think, plausibly argued. It could be that he meant something more like a right as an inclusive political process grounded in place. And that seems entirely plausible, especially when you consider his later writings. But I want to argue, or consider the argument, that Lefebvre means precisely what he says, that the right to the city is in fact a right. It's a legitimate moral claim on others. Now, on the face of it, that probably seems like a ridiculous thesis to defend. Because at first blush, Lefebvre seems so obviously to toe the Marxist line on rights. And in fact, for a book titled Le droit à la ville, he says surprisingly little about the right to the city, at least explicitly. Now, I mean, to be clear, he says many things about the city, fascinating things, and anticipates so many important themes in contemporary urbanism. One of the most fascinating directions that he goes off on and sort of considers it and wanders back is the semiotic conception of the city. The city is literally sort of written, inscribed in space and place. But when we get late in the book to his brief account of the historical emergence of rights, it's entirely true to his Marxist roots. They appear, as he tells us, as emergent customs or prescriptions. They're followed by acts, enactments. And then, through a series of struggles, they're made concrete. They're given substance first as guarantees of conscience and speech and assembly, these familiar rights of revolutionary ideals, and then later as rights of children, of education, recognition, shelter. So we have a hopeful story that's entirely consistent, I think, with Marxist orthodoxy. Rights, fundamentally, are bourgeois instruments. And I think nowhere is that clearer in Lefebvre than his withering dismissal of a right to nature. He calls it a pseudo-right, he says. And he thinks it only emerges once nature's already been commodified by these processes of exchange and valued through these mechanisms of exchange. But the right to the city is clearly different. It emerges in part through the struggle of the working class, and those are necessary but not sufficient efforts, he thinks. But there are struggles to reclaim ways of living that aren't unrelentingly mediated by mechanisms of market exchange and rationalist planning. So it's not merely a bourgeois negative right, and he says as much. He doesn't think we can defend it by reference to contract or nature. But he clearly has something in mind here that is recognizable to an analytic philosopher of rights. I think it can be meaningfully characterized as a moral right. So taking Lefebvre on his own terms, I wanted to explore whether Lefebvre could consistently claim what I'm saying he may mean. And I think he can by virtue of his, I think, very sophisticated development of the early Marxist conceptions of work and alienation as central to human being. And you recall from Marx of the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts, you know, still very much engaging in Hegel. It's our multifaceted capacity to produce and express ourselves in the world that we're kind of driven to do. It's more than a base animal need. We produce even when we're not driven by need. And yet, we are driven and we work in the world and express ourselves in the world. Often, you know, this materiality to our expressions that then is distinct and different from us, this alienation, this Entfremdung, where it's apart from us, partly beyond our control. And for the early Lefebvre, who is, again, as much a rural sociologist as an urban theorist, I think this early Marxist theme is critical. It seems to have been central to the critique of everyday life as he introduces it in his magisterial study. It's a way of understanding how the concrete expression of our lives can generate the sorts of tensions that then become critical to his later analysis of the tension between processes of industrialization on the one hand and the characteristic built forms of cities on the other. So for Lefebvre, we don't merely reside and produce in the places we live. We inhabit them, expressing within and through those places a full richness of our lives in this early Marxist sense, although obviously this is where you also see some of the influence of Heidegger on Lefebvre. And central, I think, to this vision of sort of working in place, of inhabiting a place, is this conception of vital social needs. And Lefebvre calls them anthropological needs which are socially elaborated. And so think of the needs for creative activity and work above and beyond mere material production, material consumption, needs for symbolism, the imaginary in play, as he puts it. And of course, I think, this is an explicit in Lefebvre, but the requirement of time and places where those needs can be expressed and satisfied. So for Lefebvre, this contrast between the l'œuvre and produit, this produit simple, it rests in this conception of human needs that's inevitably expressed through our social relations in time and space. And it's that distinctly social, relational conception of need that I think can justify what seems like a more familiar conception of right to the analytic philosopher. So by way of the early Marx, I think Lefebvre accepts an understanding of human needs based in our nature as complex social beings. And that amounts to a compelling reason for guaranteeing the bases of those needs. Now, you can debate whether there are those sorts of needs, and whether they rise to the standard that someone applying, say, Leif Wynaar's theory of Hoffeldian rights, you can ask whether they successfully ground such a rights claim. But my aim here is more modest than that. I only mean to show one plausible way that Lefebvre's invocation of a right to the city can be understood as more than mere rhetoric. If the right is rooted in claims about the central importance of the uses of the spaces we inhabit, and if those uses are vital to living a properly human life, fully expressed, then we can and should affirm them as rights. So that, I mean, that might not ultimately hold together as an argument, but that seems consistent internally with Lefebvre's own account, it seems to me. But still, even if you accept this reading of Lefebvre, why is it a right to the city rather than a right to place or to use values linked to those places? The city is, after all, a refuge of use values for Lefebvre. But why the city? And for Lefebvre, it seems to me the answer lies in the historical interplay of two complex processes. First, there are dimensions of centrality for which towns and cities, especially in Europe, have been traditionally the spatial locus. And we have here distinct stages of centrality characteristic to the dominant modes of production, but also dominant urban forms. And so we see here also Lefebvre distancing himself from the French, more structuralist Marxist tradition, because the dimensions of centrality that characterize the cities historically for each of these stages are political, ecclesiastic, and commercial. And it's that latter category which makes the medieval city in particular vital to Lefebvre's story, because that's where commerce finds roots, but also it's where the conditions of sort of complex and conflictual human interaction, thank you, are situated. So the rise in the medieval city and the ultimate transition to capitalism and the ascendance of industry present contradictory forces of which the medieval city is sort of the focus. So in the medieval city, there emerges a focus on wealth and crafts and arts. There's some limited but significant enfranchisement of the peasants. The city air makes them free. But the city also becomes the primary site of production and exchange. These resultant networks of trade between cities means that wealth becomes increasingly mobile. And so while cities are also become the focus of community, which they inherit from the village and guild, they become the sites of intense class struggles. And these are groups that Lefebvre calls rivals in their love of the city. Now, historically, forces of industrialization eventually prevail. But it's in these tensions in the medieval city that Lefebvre, I think, sees a path back to ways of expressing those social needs in places that are especially suited to them, grounded in complex nexus of use values that are also linked to exchange values, but they're linked in this dynamic and unstable way in these spaces. So it seems to me that Lefebvre's right to is a right to the city, because that's the mode of living that best allows us to flourish as these sorts of persons together. And his description, his account of Paris between the 1840s and the end of the Haussmann reform periods, I think he provides the clearest of many iterations of this idea, where urban life, he says, suggests meetings and the confrontation of differences, reciprocal knowledge, these sort of ideological and political confrontations associated with ways of living, all coexisting. But the logic of industrialization that comes to dominate urban society is then importantly distinct from the city. And so for Lefebvre, the urban society, as industrialization sort of writes it back onto the city, is actually built on the ruins of the city. So here, urban society becomes sort of separate from those essential tensions of the urban forms that gave birth to them in the medieval city. And so given the global nature of the logic of industrialization and its drive to urbanize society in this particular way, Lefebvre, I think, presents the rights of the city as a way to recapture what's distinctly urban from that process, and to gain access to the spatial and institutional terms of centrality that are essential to realizing vital needs that require social elaboration. And so that, by way of conclusion, is the way, I think, that Lefebvre both argues for something familiar to analytic political philosophers as a right, and situates it, I think, plausibly in an historical account of what's distinctive about a particular kind of urban form. It's a right to the city. Thanks.
I'm not sure I understood the argument, and I did kind of skim the paper. So if I understood it right, it sounds like your reading of Lefebvre has him being very like ahistorical in a way that doesn't seem Marxist. Because are you saying that, in other words, so for Marx, like, we are these productive beings, and he has this kind of like human nature kind of claim about it, but the way that manifests itself is going to change as the relations of production change. But are you saying that for Lefebvre, like, we kind of got it right at this one historical moment, and now that's over? And so maybe I'm misunderstanding you, but if so, then in what sense can we have a right to something that doesn't even exist anymore?
Yeah.
For Marx, we've not yet arrived at the form of productive relations that can really enable us to enjoy, you know, not being alienated from our labor. I don't know. I'm not sure if I understood you right, but if so, it just is kind of confusing to me. Is this ahistorical, and have we kind of lost the one form in which we could enjoy our like relationship to the city in a way that would be, you know, fit our nature?
It is confusing. It is ahistorical. it's not that. But no, I think you're right to pick up on something I'm kind of rushing through here, that I think Lefebvre, on my reading, and again, I've been sort of attacked when I presented this to a group of urbanists the first time I sort of put it together. The one attack here is that I'm just, you know, this is wishful thinking. I'm reading into Lefebvre this sort of weird Rousseauian, Hegelian hybrid of early Marx, and ignoring everything that Marx and Engels then say in the German ideology. But I guess it just seems to me that in the text there's grounds for thinking that Lefebvre is innovating and using this early Marxist concept of alienation in a way that is divorced from the more historicist readings that the structural Marxists, for instance, take from the German ideology. And yeah, I think that's what he's doing. I think he's saying there's a way to read him is to say that there's this, you know, understanding of sort of human needs that are socially expressed that is not as bound to the characteristic modes of production and the processes of sort of the unfolding of the tensions that drive us to a different mode.
But have
of production,
we lost
social
the
relations.
One? I thought you said at the end that we've lost this one sort of urban form in which we.
Well,
could
I think where Lefebvre does tell an historical sort of tale is to say that in that medieval city, at that moment, in that characteristic mode of production, there's a tension that pulls us historically one way. But I don't think he's committed to that as being a story of inevitable loss that we can't recover from, or again, this sort of steamroller of history idea that we just got to wait it out and get to the more traditional Marxist story of the revolution. I think Manuel Castells and David Harvey, I think, sort of pick up a bit on this and are very nervous because they think that what Lefebvre is really doing is telling us a story about the primacy of urbanization and then telling the story of industrial capitalism in light of these characteristic features of cities. And they think, well, that's just exactly wrong. It's a story about the processes of capitalism unfolding and industrialization proceeding and sort of an uneven geography of the development of capitalism that generates certain urban forms. But I guess if I have to take sides in that fight, I think Lefebvre can tell a consistent story that, yeah, isn't. I mean, there's a reason that a lot of the French Marxists sort of came to be a little suspicious of him. I think he still saw this as a Marxist story. But yeah, it puts certain forms of urbanization first and then tells a story about the development of industrial capitalism, developing first outside of the cities and then coming back to sort of, you know, rewrite the built forms and institutional forms of the city in light of this logic of industrial production. But that the city came first and that the tension arose in these medieval forms and that we could recapture the refuge of use values that he saw in these cities simply by trying to, you know, contest that logic of industrialization as it writes itself into the city. And that's the primacy of use values then is this call to a certain claim that other people, again, say is more like a political rallying cry. And I'm saying, well, it may be that, but it could also be articulated as something that I think, you know, someone more attuned to analytic ethics and political philosophy would recognize as a rights claim. It just happens to be grounded in this kind of Marxist story, early Marxist story.
I really liked your paper, and you did persuade me. That is that it that it makes sense to interpret the word right literally. So I wonder if you would accept the following addition to your claim, the theory of estrangement there were four things you were estranged from: species being, which I never quite figured out, but I guess there's something there. The product of people's labor, and that's what you're talking about there, and then two others, which is the process of labor itself and each other. So when you take the process of work itself and other people, then I think of Lefebvre's notion that Lefebvre, incidentally, who was a heterodox Marxist, like all of the urban Marxists, all of them, except Engels, but certainly the other situationists, Neuenhuss and De Boer, certainly even an earlier generation, Aragon, Benjamin. But if you take those two things together, I make sense of them in terms of his notion of a city as an oeuvre, or as an experimental, entity, which means a work in progress. And when he talks about the right, I'd always thought the right of the city, and I never thought of it literally as a right, but now you've persuaded me I should, is the right to participate with others in the work in progress, which is the city. And evidence for thinking this way came from the World Urban Forum, which meets every 5 years. And the last time it met was in Rio de Janeiro. I was there. David Harvey was the keynote speaker. That's how he interpreted it. And almost all of the speakers, especially the speakers who were the Brazilian ordinary folks, not ordinary folk, but the they were NGOs and so on in the audiences, they were talking about the right to the city in terms of the right to participate in the life and the growth and the development of the city. So it's not just the product, which is the city, but the process of producing that product.
Yeah, I think I'd accept that. I mean, interestingly, I think Lefebvre himself is happy to a more capacious understanding of alienation that includes the sort of overcoming the alienation from each other. What's interesting, the other flank then that this reading can be attacked on is then to say, oh, look, then you're into this total alienation thing where we're trying to sort of recover from all these forms of alienation, and the result is this kind of utopian vision where we're sort of not alienated from any of this stuff, and it's like, come on. And Lefebvre, in introducing the critique of everyday life, is very attuned to this criticism. And he thinks the only solution is to understand the characteristic forms of alienation that correspond to the characteristic sort of modes of production that appear historically, and to confront them with the lived experiences of people actually living in them. He saw this as a kind of sociological method, not as a kind of philosophical postulate. And he thought we had to be very careful about that, or we would end up sort of, just treating, taking really seriously the passage in the manifesto where we sort of fish in the evening, and or poetry in the evening, fish in the afternoon, and this sort of fighting total alienation. And
you do philosophy in one of those time periods.
Yeah, there's philosophizing in there. There's definitely no cleaning the kitchen, but but yeah, Lefebvre was attuned to this, I think, in a very interesting way, a suggestive way, as a methodological postulate. I find it fascinating, and it doesn't seem to turn up as much later when he turns to these more philosophical questions. But it's clear, he's very very sensitive to the ways in which we understand alienation in this Marxist tradition, and the dangers of focusing on every possible way in which we could alienate ourselves from our product and our labor and from others. So, yeah.
So I've never read Lefebvre, though I probably should. He writes really big, long books, right? Isn't there one that's like 3 volumes? And
yep, that's the Critique of Everyday Life.
Right. I'm not that interested right now in whether you have Lefebvre or right, but just on evaluating the claim. So it seems to me that there's a strong and a weak claim that you could infer from what you just said. And the strong claim seems to me to be just so completely implausible that it would, sort of argue against my actually reading Lefebvre, because, the weaker claim, which strikes me as plausible.
Can I just stop you there? I'm going with the weaker claim.
Okay. The weaker claim would seem to me to run something like this. There are people who are subjected to let's call them urban processes. They work within the city. They are central to the economic life of the city, and they don't, I'll use terms very loosely, benefit in any way from what the city has to offer. So they're alienated in the sense that they participate in something that they don't that doesn't contribute to their sort of species being. But it's only because they are at the outset involved in these processes, right? So they have a right to something given their starting point. That's the weaker claim. The stronger claim is, people in the countryside, like in deepest, really deep rural area that I can't even name, who are completely uninvolved in any way, shape, or form with process of the city, they have a right to the city too, because it turns out that it is the only way in which to actualize their whatever species being. So the stronger claim strikes me as completely, wildly implausible, right? And it, but in a way, it would sort of connect with, I mean, didn't Marx say that, talk about the idiocy of
rural life, right?
Of the idiocy of rural life, you know, sometimes when you look at voting pattern, anyway. So it would sort of jibe with something that is there in the Marxist sort of tradition, but it would make the claim, the first claim strikes me as interestingly, you know, considerable, whereas the second just strikes me as yeah, you know, nuts.
I'm still going with the weaker claim.
But I'm asking you a question of which is truest to Lefebvre.
I think the way I've been reading what he says about this right, as distinct from, say, a right to nature, I think is something more like the weaker claim. But I think interestingly, when he writes about, you know, the revolution urbaine, when we get to this conception of urban society as a virtual thing that's actualizing itself, I think he really thinks that the logic of industrialization has already kind of done away with rural life. This Marxist distinction that he depended on, where we need, you know, the proletariat to be urbanized in this way, so that they can become aware of their condition, that doesn't make sense anymore. I think he thinks that the distinction you just drew is that even when you're out in the country, most of what is valuable about the countryside agricultural production is defined by urban society, and that's anchored in, you know, a way in which this logic of industrialization has written the modern metropolis. So, you know, I think he kind of offers an empirical claim that would suggest that, you know, and again,
yeah, yeah, that,
you know, look, I wouldn't assert the strong claim, but it turns out that there's no rural life that would make it sound as idiotic as you just did.
Right. So can I just have a quick, is there a long, long queue?
There's one more person on queue. So.
Okay. If I could just have a comeback at that then. So it's actually an unfulfillable right, right? Because there are, it turns out that there are going to be some people who are subject to the city in some way, who aren't going to be, let's say, subjects of the city.
Yeah.
Or in the city.
Yeah. I think if I seriously want to push this reading, The Urban Revolution is a book I have to engage with, and it's going to be difficult because it just seems to me like he sets up this view of where we're going that makes it sound like a lot of people are going to be sort of in this position where they can't really exercise this right the way I have him articulating it here. So either I'm wrong or it's not helpful to read this book the way I'm reading it. Or Lefebvre, yeah, just ends on a rather depressing note.
Okay. Well, maybe we can read it together and have a virtual reading group or something.
I wonder, maybe for the paper, if you keep working on it, maybe you should do more distinguish between this right to the city concept is a lot, especially interpreted as participation, is a lot bolder than the typical discourse about preventing homeless people from being deprived of right to use public space and preventing people from being voluntarily displaced. That might be worth drawing out more in the paper. But I wonder, is the right to the city a claim that can be made on capitalist cities and honored, or is it implied there has to be some sort of socialist revolution / reform in order to be honored? Does some sort of reform or revolutionary claim follow necessarily from taking this idea seriously?
Yeah, I don't know. I need to think about that a lot harder. I mean, I guess it's a cop out, but I would say my aims here are a lot more modest than that. It's just to make this interpretive move to show that Lefebvre isn't just, you know, heady about the Paris Spring and talking about rights because it's the 60s. You know, he can be read in this way. Yeah, whether that right could meaningfully be exercised in what we think of today as the neoliberal city, I'm not. Personally, I'm pessimistic. I suspect he would have been too. I'm just not sure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.